The following message is by Jason DeRoshi, Research Professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and Content Developer and Global Trainer with Hands to the Plow Ministries. You can find more from Dr. DeRoshi at www.jasonderoshi.com.
The final words of the preacher or of the narrator in Ecclesiastes were these: "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole of the human," or as the ESV has it, "the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." It's those words that lead us into the greatest of all songs. 1 Kings chapter 4 tells us that Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. And this is the Song of Songs. It may just be the best love song ever written, or it is the peak of all 1,005 that Solomon wrote. But just as you would express the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, this is the Song of Songs, or the Holy of Holies, meaning the most holiest of all places, the strongest of all kings, the greatest of all lords, here the supremest of all songs. And that being stated, it's a book that very few Christians ever want to touch. What do we do with it? How do we handle it? And throughout church history, it has been a constant challenge. I think in this book, we are getting a marriage manual in the midst of a cursed and broken world, a marriage manual for understanding how singles and how marrieds should withstand, withhold themselves from temptation, and embrace the beauty of chastity within the marriage relationship. The book is set up as a love song with several episodes, I'm going to argue, that together celebrate the sexual love and marital fidelity between one man and one woman. And then it includes a significant caution. In fact, we, I think, miss the weight of the caution. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. To word it that way is to miss that this is actually an oath curse. It's written in Hebrew, if you arouse and awaken love, as that which it pleases, and then it leaves off the end. Because just to declare the curse could bring it. But this is how curses are often shaped. You get the if part, and you don't get the then part. But if you arouse and awaken love too early, then cursed are you. God will find you out, because every deed, every secret thing, whether good or evil, he will bring into judgment. The last line of Ecclesiastes. He knows. And this book is going to contrast an unhealthy approach to sexuality with a very beautiful and healthy approach to sexuality. And it's something that should be proclaimed. And if there's parts of this book that make you feel uncomfortable, it may be that they're actually supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. Because in those moments of the book, it's actually portraying sexuality in an objectifying, exploitative way rather than in a proper way to approach it. So let's consider this book. But before we do, I'm going to open in prayer and ask the Lord for help. Oh, Father, what a gift you have given us in marital intimacy. I'm asking that you would stoke fires for there to be an unbreakable, white-hot delight between husband and wife. Indeed, the very flame of Yahweh. And that we would not settle for outward, exploitative, objectifying forms of sexuality that the world has to offer, all the while hoping for the day when the ultimate relationship between Christ and his bride will be consummated. Come, Lord Jesus, we pray. Meet us as we look at this book, and then as we look at our next. Help us, I pray, in Christ. Amen. So this book is, for so many, a can't touch this. And it's because of the graphic details that it has within the book. Throughout history, there's been several approaches. Many of you are familiar with the allegorical, such that let me delight in your twin breasts becomes let me delight in the Old Testament and in the New. Such that the imagery, the figurative portrayal, whether through garden language or architectural language, becomes merely a launching point for the actual meaning of the book, which is the relationship between God and Israel, or Christ and his church. And the challenge with the allegorical interpretation by itself, as if that's the only point of the book, is that there is nothing in the text that would suggest that's how we're supposed to read it. In Ephesians 5, Paul builds the parabolic nature of language by saying, husbands, love your wives as Christ loves the church. He notes that there's a connection. In the book of Hosea, as Yahweh portrays Israel as his bride, indeed an unfaithful bride, he elevates Hosea's marriage to Gomer in a parabolic way. He addresses Hosea and then addresses Israel. And he allows the two to be blending together all in the same book so that we understand that one is pointing to the other. Not so in this book. God shows up in only one place, in verse 8 of chapter 8. And it's actually a shortened form of God's name. I think the ESV renders it the flame of the Lord. Very literally, it's the flame of Yah. So, it's actually verse 6 of chapter 8. Love. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of Yah, the shortened form of Yahweh. True love, as God purposes it to be, is something he is the fuel for. He is the awakener of what God has joined together. What God has joined together, let no man put us under. In the midst of exile, longing for God to overcome curse with blessing, one of the gifts that he gave his people was this portrait of right thinking about sexuality. Because in the brokenness of the world, there is curse and there is problem. There's nothing in the book that suggests this is principally and solely about God's relationship with his people or the Messiah's interrelationship with his bride. Instead, it's portrayed as the true, deep commitment a woman has to a man and that a man has to a woman. And yet, within the context of the book as a whole, indeed, even in the way that it alludes to Genesis chapters 2 and 3, that it's anticipating the greater union. So that the marriage that is indeed in this book is viewed as a type or a picture of a more ultimate relationship. And if you want to be among those who, living in the midst of exile, separated from the ultimate realization of new creation, it hasn't come yet, but if you want to be a part of that, then one of the ways that you'd find yourself making it is by celebrating sexuality this way, in the hope of the day when the Messiah will arrive and capture his bride. So, whether we call it allegory or typology, I think that's there, but I'm prone to think typology is better, that we're supposed to see this principally about human relationship that in turn points to a more ultimate relationship. The cultic approach to the book, we don't have to take that much time on. It simply is the idea that this is a sacred marriage between the gods, and that it's been brought into Jewish literature, and Moses' condemnation of those kind of pagan notions suggests that has no place, that interpretation has no place in the scripture. Godly prophets, priests, and poets all recognize this book as sacred. It's part of the Bible. And they wouldn't have viewed it, approached it through the cultic lens. Well, how about this one? Many, many believers today say it's not just a love song, it's multiple love songs that are actually disconnected, and they don't tell a story. They simply are put into a series without progression, meaning you could put them in any different order. It's several independent love songs celebrating a proper view of marriage. Marital love between a man and a woman. My challenge here is that this book has refrains. It has repetition. It has what appears to be a plot line, such that there are individuals and there are all of these temptations and challenges coming upon these individuals, calling into question whether they will make it. And then we come to the end of the book. Yahweh's name shows up for the first time, and true, pure love is celebrated, and that which is abhorrent to God is rejected. It seems to me the whole is actually working together to communicate a massive message to a people living in a world that has no comprehension of what true, pure, moral sex is. So I don't think this is independent love songs. Indeed, the very first line of the book says the Song of Songs, suggesting the next 8 chapters are a unit that we want to read together. So that leads me to the dramatic interpretation that this is a drama that we don't need a stage for because it's being played out day in and day out all around us. It was in Solomon's day, all the more in our day, where media and our phones open the door for so much so fast. The question becomes, how many characters? How do we understand this book? Is Solomon a good guy, or is he a fool? I think when it says the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, it's most likely meaning not that it was written for Solomon, but it was written by Solomon. But we have to wrestle truly with the fact that Scripture portrays this Solomon as someone far from the ideal husband. Nor was he the ideal king. He has 700 wives, 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. I think because he's able to write books like this, God recaptured that heart late in his life, indicating he indeed was one of the elect, set apart by God. And yet, so much of his life was broken and twisted, not the exemplar that we would expect to be elevated in a book on marriage. Indeed, the book does portray him as elevated, but I don't think in a positive way. Rather, he's elevated in a distant way, in a flaunting way. And indeed, by the time we get to the end of the book, the reality is he thinks he can have any woman he wishes. And he's willing to abuse her? Or let someone pay and have a woman from his harem? And yet the woman in this book says, "No, I will not open my garden to you, for I have another." I don't think this is a two-character drama between Solomon and Lady Solomon called the Shulamite. He's Shlomo, she's the Shulamite. So some say, well, that's Mrs. Solomon. I think it's a play on words. This is how we're supposed to, like, what everyone around her wants her to be. One more Lady Solomon. And she says no. And in this one life, Solomon saw something that caught him off guard. Unexpected. So that when God recaptured his heart and he looked back on the story of his life, he remembered that one woman and her love and deep commitment for her shepherd boy, that she would not let him go and she would not open herself up to all of his temptations. I think it's a three-character drama wherein we have Mr. Wise, who is the shepherd boy, and Mr. Fool, who is Solomon. And then there is the maiden and a bunch of virgins within the harem of Solomon. The harem is made up of two groups. There's the house of the virgins, and there's the house of the concubines. The concubines can never leave. Once the king has claimed them, they are not free to go. But then there's the house of the virgins, and all of them, think about Esther, working for over a year with all the perfuming, all the ointments, all of the exercise to get her body ready for when she would move out of the house of the virgins into the house of the concubines, or in her instance, the house of the queen. Well, here we're looking at a young lady, I believe, who has been captured, brought into the house of virgins against her will, and she has another man outside the gate. And I'm going to propose, in that relationship, Solomon saw something unlike anything he had ever seen before. And this book is calling every young woman and every young man to say, I want to be that kind of contra-world believer. Who's willing to say no to all the world's temptations, all the objectifying of human sexuality, and put it in its proper place. The place that truly honors God and that sets a person up to enjoy life on the other side of judgment. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. After the superscription, we're going to see this woman in the house of the virgins being tempted already by Solomon and tempted by the ladies in waiting. And her declaration from the beginning is, that's not who I am. And I have another. Then we're going to see the young man show up and yet leave. Leave under the, like, he's going to make it up to the gate, and the girl's going to say, I can't go. Wait until the storm passes and the shadows flee. And the storm is her life in the harem. Until I can get out, just wait. Stay for me. Stay loyal to me. I need you to stay faithful to me. Then he's gone. And he's gone for a big part of the book. The good guy, Mr. Wisdom. And so think in Proverbs, you've got Lady Wisdom, Lady Folly. Song of Songs, you've got Mr. Wisdom, Mr. Folly. And enter in Mr. Folly from chapter 3 forward. The pressure on this young girl is great. Solomon arrives in all of his glory and is going to be calling her in to partake of what he is opening up to every other woman on the street. And all the women are going to be calling, come on, participate, participate. Be exploited, be objectified. Your heart needs it. And she's going to refrain and refrain and push it back until the end of the book when her man finally arrives and she testifies to true, enduring, God-entranced love. So, this is where we are headed. If you arouse, and if you awaken love unto which it delights, and you do it at the wrong time, then the implication is, cursed are you. That refrain is going to show up twice in the book. Indeed, it'll show up a third time, but it's going to change at the very end, because all of a sudden, we've moved from the time to exert love, what it ultimately desires, that desire, we've moved from the time when it's not appropriate to the time when it is appropriate. And the oath curse is actually going to turn into a question with the answer now. Now is the time. So here's how it works. 2:7. And these refrains, the three refrains, and there's a partial refrain that's added in that is going to shape a middle portion in one section. But three refrains shape the body of the book. Three parts shape the body. And then there's a superscription and a conclusion. But these three elements shape the body. In 2:7, if you arouse and awaken love unto which it delights, O daughters of Jerusalem. In the ESV, it simply says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love. But what I'm saying is that the Hebrew text has this, that adjure is, I cause you to swear, make an oath before me. If I arouse or if I awaken love at the wrong time, unto what it so longs for, and I do so at the wrong time, then understood, cursed am I. We see that in 2:7. We see it again in 3:5. Exact same wording. Then in 8:4, it's going to say, frame it differently. It's going to say, I adjure you, I cause you to swear, O daughters of Zion. But then it doesn't say if anymore. It raises it as a question. What should you arouse? And what should you awaken? And she's come to the point where she is free. Her man has come to claim her, and she is now out. She's in his embrace, and it's going to be declared, What should you arouse and what should you awaken? The love unto which it delights. And she enters into her lasting marriage with her man. So this is the structure of the book. We're going to walk through the book now. If I could, I would take out all of the bold headings that my ESV translators have put in, and I would also remove every occurrence of he, she, and others, because I think it just leads the reader in wrong directions. All of those, and especially the case in poetry, when you're in poetry, much more interpretation is having to happen when you're doing your translation. Because there's many more figures of speech. The grammar is more terse. So it's more challenging to discern what's going on. And the translators in all contemporary versions have added a whole bunch of headings. And there's even footnotes that tell us, like, I have under, just over top of chapter 1, verse 2, she. Footnote, the translators have added speaker identifications based on the gender and number of the Hebrew words, wanting to help you, the reader, to know how to go back and forth. But I think that at key points, they're making decisions that actually distract us from what's going on. So try to track with me as we go through here. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. This is the greatest of all love songs, the best one. A song likely by Solomon himself. So we begin reading, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For your love is better than wine, your anointing oils are fragrant. Let him kiss me." Verse 4, "Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers." I'm not certain that we're hearing the main female character in this book yet. Instead, what we're hearing is the song of the virgin household. This is what they experience. And there's a new girl in town. And they want her to know what they can do. What she can expect. They declare, "We will exult and rejoice in you, young lady. We will extol your love more than wine." Now, your love is masculine. Rejoice in you is feminine. In one breath, they're talking to this new girl on the block. In another breath, they're celebrating before the king. "We will extol your love to her more than wine. Rightly do they love you." I think these ladies are caught up in the king. And yet the woman responds, this new girl on the block, "I'm very dark, but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem. Like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Don't gaze at me because I'm dark, because the sun has looked upon me." She's not used to the building. She's a country girl. Her skin is dark. That is her home, not this place. "Why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions?" Why should I be among this group? This is not my place. I'm not like you. They say, or the king says, "If you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow in the tracks of the flock." If you don't understand what your responsibilities are, just follow these other girls, and they'll end up right in my chamber. And so will you. "Pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tents. I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck in strings of jewels. We will make for you, they say, ornaments of gold, studded with silver. We're going to make you beautiful. Stick it out, girl. Last the entire time of preparation. You're going to be great for the king. The king says, you're going to be one of the girls. If you don't know what to do, just follow them. I know where the end is, he says. While the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. Verse 13, I think when you read my beloved in the book, you're hearing the true maiden thinking about her man, and that man is not Solomon. Solomon is on his couch. There's temptation luring, and yet she declares, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Her brother, her beloved is elsewhere. Solomon says, you're beautiful, my love. Behold, you're beautiful. Your eyes are doves. Behold, you're beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Our couch is green. The beams of our house are cedar. Our rafts are pine. Our rafters are pine. There's a tension going on, I believe, in the text. As a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women, Solomon claims. As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men, she responds. With great delight, I sat in his shadow, and his tree was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house. His banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. I think we have this tension going on between the young girl, the harem, and Solomon. And the young girl is declaring, first time in the book, I have someone else. This is not my world. She says in verse 7 of chapter 2, I cause you to swear, I urge you. I place an oath curse upon you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the does of the field, that you not stir or awaken love until it pleases. Or if you stir and awaken love unto its end before it's the right time, then cursed are you. So far, she has withheld the advances. In verse 8, the voice of my beloved. She hears him at the door, leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills, coming for his girl. Verse 16, my beloved is mine, she says. I am his. Echoing, I will be your God. You will be my people, brought into the marriage setting. He grazes among the lilies. And then it says, until the day breathes. Well, that's one way you could read the text. It could also be until the storm, not yom meaning day, but yom too meaning storm. Until the storm passes and the shadows flee, turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag in the cleft of the mountains. He shows up at the castle. And she says, until the storm passes, until this dark situation in our relationship is over, until I am no longer restricted from you, don't come near, lest you be harmed. Turn, run back to the mountains where we first met one another, where we first fell in love. Turn, and go. She sends him away, her love, her beloved. But then, in the night, on her bed, she wrestles. After that refrain, she meets her man, she sends her man away, and then she has a dream. A dream that he came and he left, and her love for him was awakened, and she couldn't find him anywhere. And so then we get a partial oath statement. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field. Actually, sorry, this is another full oath statement. If you stir up or awaken love too early unto its end, understood, cursed you will be. Sorry, I failed to move ahead in the PowerPoint. We're up to 3:6. Solomon arrives. What is that coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, as audacious as can be, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant. Behold, it's the litter of Solomon with 60 mighty men, some of the mighty men of Israel, all of them wearing swords, experts in war, all designed to elevate the majesty of this man. King Solomon made himself a chair, a couch designed for lovemaking from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Do you get it? This is how Solomon is portrayed in the book. Multiple women, the daughters of Jerusalem, enhancing his royal couch. Go out, O daughters of Zion, look upon King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of his heart. There could be here sexual imagery regarding a different type of crown or head. Think circumcision. And it is the testimony of the ladies in waiting. Will you take part? Will you be among this group, young lady? Solomon sees the girl. Behold, you're beautiful, my love. And now we get one of those sections of the book that are hard and uncomfortable to read through. And at least as I'm understanding this text, it's supposed to make us uncomfortable because it's contrasting what is right rather than displaying what is good. This is how the world approaches sexuality. And we see it in all the movies. We see it on the billboards. It's the declaration of objectification. Behold, you're beautiful, my love. Behold, you're beautiful. And everything is outward now in the description. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like the flocks of goats. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. Your lips like scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks like the halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of gazelle, that graze among the lilies, until the day breeze and the shadows flee. That is, until the storm passes and the shadows flee, she declares, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. Verse 6, I think, is rejection, not embrace. You're not my man. Verse 7, you're altogether beautiful, my love. There's no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. You've captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. Verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine. Verse 12, though, clarifies her response. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. The garden is a metaphor in this book. Her man is out among the garden. His fields where he's doing his labors. Solomon has his own gardens. And at one level, it's the physical gardens that he has created. At another level, it's all the ladies in his harem. Her body is her garden, and she will not open it to him. She's a garden that is locked. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all the choice its fruits. He's still pressing her. He's tempting her. Verse 16, awake, O north wind. O come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden. Awaken her. Open her up. But she refuses. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choice fruits. And you, Solomon, are not him. Hear the interchange between Solomon and the ladies in waiting. I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb, my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. And then we hear the declaration, eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love, as many as want. I'm seeing this invitation of Solomon to the many. Whereas this girl is standing apart. She sent her man away and he hasn't returned yet. And now we see her heart once again. The maiden's desire and dream of loss. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved, he's knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. My head is wet with dew. I'm standing out in the rain, waiting for you. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch. My heart was thrilled. I arose to open, but my beloved had turned and gone. That sense of longing when she is held captive. The ladies then raise the question. Sorry, we get this partial oath formula then in verse 8. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, what should you tell him? The question is raised, that I am lovesick. So it's a partial oath. It doesn't bring a curse upon them. Apart from, if you find him and you don't tell him this, may you be judged. That would be the sense. But let him know, if you find him, I am lovesick. And now the ladies jump in. Verse 9, they raise the question, why do you think your beloved is better? What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful of young women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you declare curses over us? My beloved. And now she's just going to talk about him. But notice that there's no hint of impropriety or unhealth in the way that she talks about him. In fact, she talks about him in radiant language that it actually challenges me. It's as if when she thinks of her man, she thinks about him in his eschatological state. Perfect. Where his upper section is bigger than his lower section. Where he is faithful and kind, strong and able, wise, always present, caring. She talks about her man through the lens of the ideal of what he's being made into. It's challenging to me as I think about how I talk about my spouse and how my spouse would talk about me. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. Put 10,000 people in a row and I would pick him every day. You want a girl who talks about you like that? Be godly. Say no to sin. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a pool. His cheeks like the bed of spices, mounds of sweet swelling herbs. His lips like lilies. His arms rods of gold. His body polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is sweet, and he's altogether desirable. This is my beloved. This is my friend. Not my object, not my short time toy, he doesn't treat me like a dog in heat. He doesn't treat me like a mannequin, as if I'm not a person. This is my friend. This is my beloved, O daughters of Jerusalem. They then say, well, if he's so important and if he's so great, where is he gone? Where is he? That's verse 1 of chapter 6. Where is your beloved gone? Where has your beloved turned? If you want us to tell him, let us know where he is. She says, my beloved has gone down to the garden, to the gardens and to gather lilies, to graze in the gardens, to gather lilies. He's gone to the bed of spices. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. Now, I think the image here is that that's actually where he is. He's a shepherd. He is out doing what he's supposed to be doing. But the way that garden imagery is used metaphorically in this book, it's, where is he? They say. He is out there being absolutely committed to me. He's on a business trip, and I have no worry because I know I am his and he is mine. He is doing the same thing that I am doing, saying no to temptation. He is living in his garden, and I am it. I think that's what's going on. Well, into this beautiful declaration comes Solomon once again. And this interchange of Solomon and the harem praising the maiden, and yet she not buying it. You're beautiful as Tirzah, my love. Lovely as Jerusalem, says Solomon. Awesome as an army with banners. I find it intriguing. This happens a couple times in the book where she's portrayed as a competing army, as if he's recognizing this is war. She won't give me her heart. Turn away your eyes from me. You're just overwhelming to me. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes. Not one of them has lost its young. He's describing her again. Your cheeks are like the halves of pomegranates behind your veil. And then there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. There we have it. This isn't my favorite movie. But I watch it with my girl. It's one of the Love Comes Softly movies. It's not my genre of choice, but there's a moment where the daughter is being pursued by a man. And the man, he's this wealthy train guy. How many have seen that one? Anybody? Love Comes Softly? Okay, we got a couple hands. All right. Anyway, she's being pursued by this wealthy train owner, so lots of money, and he stops and he says, "Do you not realize that I could have any woman that I wanted?" And she stops and she says, "Well, go have them." That's the sense I'm getting. Here's Solomon. He's part of his way to woo her in is to say, "Girl, look, there are 60 queens that I've married and 80 concubines and virgins without number. I've got all these." And she's just like, "That doesn't make you attractive to me at all." "My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her, who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed. The queens, the concubines, they praised her." And yet you get to verse 13, and they're saying, "Where'd she go? Return! Return, O Shulamite!" As she walks out the door, having nothing to do with all their praise, because it's merely outward flattery that doesn't recognize her as a person who should be valued, who should be cherished. Verse 13, "Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance between two armies?" You see, that's what's happening in this whole book. It's a dance. And she is saying no to all the temptation from all of her girlfriends as they declare what is right and what is good and what is beautiful, withholding all the temptation from the captain of the football team. She's able to see, "To you, I am but an object. I want my friend. I want my friend. He is committed to me, and I am committed to him." Solomon's final advance comes at the beginning of chapter 7. "How beautiful are your feet in sandals." Every one of his advances is simply describing her form. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. The eyes are pools in Heshbon. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. Yet she says in verse 10, I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. You get to the end of chapter 7, and this girl now turns her attention, and this is where it's going to be for the rest of the book, turns her attention to her man. She says, come, my beloved, let us go. I'm done. I have said no to his final pursuit. And I'm out of there. The sense I get is he's rejected her. The king, that is. The king has rejected her. And she's free to go. Let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines are budded. Let me see all the work you've been doing. That's one reality that is being said. But then there's another reality that is, let's go delight in the garden. Let's see Eden renewed. Let's come and consummate this relationship. Let's check and see if the grapes have blossomed, if the grape blossoms have opened, the pomegranates are in bloom. Let us see if now is the time. And then she says, there I will give you my love. She was like a closed garden when Solomon pursued her. And now it's time. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits. These are the doors of the garden that are now opened. New as well as old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you, and none would despise me. I would lead you up and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink and the juice of my pomegranate. And then, as in the earlier part of the book, his left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. And she says for a final time, but now in a different way, I cause you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem. What should you arouse? And what should you awaken? Trying to think of how I had it translated. What should you arouse and what should you awaken is the question. Answer, the love unto which it delights. No longer do we have a curse oath. Now, in the context of saying goodbye to these young women, she says, this is what love was made for. And she raises the question, what should you arouse? What should you awaken? Not if you arouse or awaken love too soon, may you be accursed. What should you arouse? What should you awaken in such a moment? Answer, the love unto which it delights. Open up the doors of the garden and enter in, because God is pleased with this. That's the final refrain of the book. And it leads us now into the conclusion. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? It recalls the wording of Solomon's entrance. What is that coming up from the wilderness like columns of smoke? It's the litter of Solomon, and he is sitting on his love couch. It recalls that, but now it replaces Solomon with her man. What is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? She is with him. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There, your mother was in labor with you. There, she who bore you was in labor. So it seems as though they've gone back actually to the place where he was born. And there, it ends. It doesn't take us into the marriage bed. Instead, what we read is this. Number one, true love allows for no intruders. Set me as a seal on your heart, as a seal on your arm. A seal that cannot be opened. That declaration, like a wax seal on a letter. And what it declares is, this is a letter of the king. Like a ring on the finger, set me as a seal on your heart so that it is firmly fixed and clearly read by all. I am hers. I am hers and no one else's. Love allows for no intruders. Not only that, true love is God wrought. Love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. It flashes. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of Yah. God is the maker of true love. And there is a proper jealousy for your spouse's affection. A proper jealousy to have your partner be solely yours. That is right and it is true. It's designed by God. It's a love that is stronger than death. As fierce as the grave. Something that God creates. And I pray that every one of you will experience it. It may be that God sets you apart and gives you a gift of singleness, but very few have that gift. Most people are called to put on display the greatest of all relationships. Until that time comes, celebrate that you get to taste merely the ultimate relationship. But there is a beauty that this book celebrates in that tenacious, fierce love. True love is constant and unquenchable. Look at verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. Whatever the storm brings, this kind of love will not break. And what's so sad is that so many of us have grown up in homes, me included, where the storms came and the flame of love died out. In God, you can experience something such that you can be ransomed from the futile ways of your forefathers through the precious blood of Christ. That marriage can actually work in your home, even if you never saw a pattern of it before. To taste the significance of this kind of love that is unquenchable. The waters cannot put the flame out. Because the source of that flame is otherworldly. It's not bound by the experiences of this age. Finally, true love can't be purchased. The end of verse 7. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. That's what Solomon has been trying to do throughout the entire book. And it's despicable. And Solomon is the one telling us it now. Despicable. Verse 10. I was a wall, she says, and my breasts were like towers. You couldn't claim them. You couldn't cross it. Then, I was in his eyes as one who experiences peace or brings peace. All of a sudden, that wall, that tower, was able to be entered and become a place of security and rest for one man. Peace is shalom. And one man found peace, shalom, with this woman. And then it contrasts with Shlomo. There's this relationship where peace is being enjoyed, and then there's Solomon. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. It's intriguing, the details that are given here. It's a specific location. You know who Baal is. That contrasts, I think, with the very flame of the Lord in verse 6. Solomon's ways are the ways of Baal. How about Hamon? Baal is also translated throughout the Old Testament as husband or Lord, meaning husband. Hamon, a multitude. There's true love, which is the flame of Yahweh, and then there's what Solomon brings. Being the husband of a multitude, that's where his vineyard lies. He's the husband of a multitude. That's what it means, Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. So it's using now, I think, a parable. He's got this land where he lives, and it's tauntingly called Baal Hamon by Solomon himself. He recognizes this was a place of idolatry in the form of all these women. But the language is, he has a vineyard that he lets out to keepers. So now they're his workers keeping the vineyard. That means he gets to enjoy the flock, and they get to enjoy, the produce. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. So I think there's something going on here where at one level they're talking about the fact that he has a garden and there's gardeners that he's loaned out his land to, and they're having to pay him 1,000 pieces of silver for each bit of fruit. And yet they're there and they're able to enjoy his fruit. But the parable is that he has a vineyard called his harem. And he enjoys the harem. And if you want to pay for it, you can even enjoy the harem. That's Solomon. And it's contrasting, verse 12, my vineyard. So that Solomon has his vineyard. And it even opens it up to many people. My vineyard, my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and the keepers of the fruit, 200. Point being, Solomon, you go ahead and have your vineyard. Share your love with as many as you want. Objectify all these women. Whatever you're doing, okay, that is not me. I have my garden. I have my vineyard. and it is my very own, and you get none of it. Then we come to the final words. Oh, you, hear the man, the beloved, crying out, oh, you who dwell in the gardens with companions listening for your voice. You're in a sea of others in the gardens of Solomon. Will you come? Will you come? Let me hear you. Make haste, my beloved, she cries. Be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. Come to your garden. I am yours and you're mine. This book celebrates the proper sense of desire. Her desire will be for her man. Genesis 3:16. A longing for her protector, a longing for her provider, rightly understood. Without the curse, saying no to all that is evil. You see this celebration of how God intended things to be. This is a book that shows the objectification of women through the luring of wealth, through the luring of position. Yet it provides a noble call to chastity and to faithfulness. Where's my beloved, you ask? He's out dwelling among his garden. I'm on his mind, and I need not fear. We might be separated physically, but we are close because our commitment is real. What we experience is the very flame of God. There is a beauty of viewing one's spouse through an eschatological lens. I noted that in her description of this man. What it's calling every husband to view his wife as his queen. Every wife to view her husband as her king. In the hope of the coming ultimate relationship. In contrast to the cursed view of sexuality that is portrayed in this book, what we see is the elevation of Garden of Eden-like imagery in relation to sexual intimacy that is rightly placed on the right object at the right time. That's the context for sexual purity, for moral sex. The right object at the right time, getting to delight in one another. And here we see the contrast with how the world portrays sexuality with this renewed Garden of Eden-like beautiful sexual intimacy in marriage. So that she can say, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. Or she can end the book, make haste, my beloved. Be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. And God says, that is right. The marriage bed is undefiled. Celebrate one another in this right and proper and wholesome and beautiful context. And just like the Lord's Supper allows for this sustained, as a sign of the covenant, this sustained, repetitive reinforcement of my commitment, who Jesus is for me and who I am for him. Every encounter of sexual intimacy properly placed reinforces the covenant love that you have for one another. A garden that is only open to one, where the flame of Yahweh is enjoyed and where he is honored. To enjoy sex with one's spouse is to enter a garden filled with the choicest fruits, the choicest of spices, the most beautiful of flowers. And it's supposed to be that way. Even though it's short term, it's a moment that is fuel in this book for helping exiles persevere through curse all the way to future hope and consummation. Second, Song of Songs is a typology of Christ's relationship with his church. I believe that this song truly depicts the true, pure love between a husband and a wife. But in doing so, in light of how the whole biblical canon elevates human marriage as a pointer to something higher, something more ultimate, it anticipates God's relationship with his people. As early as Exodus in the Bible, Yahweh charges Israel as his bride to not whore or commit fornication with other lovers. To not whore after or commit fornication with other lovers, meaning the gods of the nations. Then Moses tells us that this is exactly what the nation will do once they arrive in the land. They will whore after other lovers. And this is how the book of Hosea builds its entire framework. Yet we also have a psalm. I just preached it at one of our students' weddings a week and a half ago. And he's still not here because he's enjoying the flame of Yahweh. Psalm 45 elevates the king, not as the earthly king, but it calls him God. The king in Psalm 45 is called God, and then, but it's not Yahweh, because Yahweh is God's God in that text. He's sitting on an eternal throne. No earthly king had that. Only Jesus has that. And the writer of Hebrews in chapter 1 quotes that those very verses in Psalm 45, 6, and 7 and says, Jesus is this one who's called God and who is sitting underneath Yahweh as God. And the whole psalm is a wedding psalm. It's called a love song, the only psalm in the Psalter that's tagged with that title. And if the king in that psalm is Jesus, then the bride in that psalm is the church. And yet in the service, I then used it in the reverse way that Paul does. Paul in Ephesians 5 talks to husbands and wives and says this human relationship points to something greater. But in Psalm 45, it was actually depicting the ultimate relationship, and I used it in reverse to say we can learn something from the portrait of the king and the portrait of the queen in this passage as we reflect on human marriage today. All throughout Scripture, the one human relationship is a pointer to the more ultimate relationship. Israel's spiritual adultery continues in the lives of the religious leaders in Jesus' day. Jesus says he's the bridegroom who is present but who will soon be taken away. And then we learn that the church is his bride and he will return for her to consummate all things, celebrating the marriage supper of the Lamb. This book points in that direction. This whole word, as my friend Jim Hamilton has said, the whole Old Testament is a messianic document written from a messianic perspective to instill messianic hope. And that includes Song of Songs. It is a book designed to instill the hope of the coming Christ among those who treat marriage and sexuality rightly. So, I give my long summary.
The Song of Songs celebrates how Yahweh's flame of love between a husband and a wife wards off intruders, is constant and unquenchable, and generates a Garden of Eden-like intimacy that helps the relationship endure every struggle as it anticipates the Messiah's marriage with his people. Short summary. A husband and his wife should celebrate the love Yahweh gives to fight off intruders and to enjoy a Garden of Eden-like intimacy that hopes in the new creation and looks forward to the Messiah's marriage with his people. The Song of Songs. Questions or reflections on today's passage? Yes.
In chapter 1, when he's talking about her skin being darkened, is there any thoughts you have on? She says her brothers made her go out and work in the field. Is that what does that mean?
I think it probably means that her brothers made her go out and work in the field. I just mean that I think there she's likely talking about her actual situation. At the end of the book, her brothers come back in, and it almost sounds like her brothers were among those in the book who are not operating as brothers should, but were saying, you've got a good gig here. You should be going out, you should embrace this possibility to be with the king. And she's saying that this is their first introduction into the book, and I think the sense is that they have not operated as brothers should, and yet she has a man who is more a provider and protector than her brothers have been. Others, yes.
In chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, they feel like kind of out of place, and I frankly don't understand the metaphor either, to be honest. So if you could enlighten that a bit.
I'll try. It is, you notice I jumped over it. That was intentional, because these two verses are a little bit hard for me. We have a little sister, so this brings us back to, I think, the brothers that are in chapter 1. We have a sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? So what we may have here is we have a sister who's been unwilling, this is the perspective of the brothers, potentially, unwilling to recognize that she's a woman. She's kept saying no throughout the entire book to all the advances of the king and all the encouragements of the lady, as if she has no breasts, as if she has not operated, allowed her beauty and desirability to work for her advantage. And so then we, if she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Now, that mention of the door and boards of cedar, I think recalls back in 7:13, where she's talking about her man. And she says, the mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. So we're talking about like a garden gate and a wall. Like nobody can get into her. If she's a wall, we'll build on her a battlement of silver. That may have something to do with this war imagery of two armies fighting, and the brothers are declaring, that they're going to somehow overcome her? I don't know. If she's a door, we'll enclose her with boards of cedar. Is that door going to open, or is it going to be shut? I don't really know what's going on. It's hard for me to understand. But in verse 10,
She says, I was a wall, and the towers that you say were not there were there, and I knew that they were there, but it was not a garden security to be entered by anyone but my beloved. And I've opened up my door to him. So I think verse 10 is a response to verses 8 and 9. I'm just not fully certain yet how it's all working. So I'm sorry.
Oh, I appreciate that.
So if we go through this with a group of people and come out of it and someone's like, I identify more with Solomon or with the woman in the harem, what would be a way to address it, move forward? Or
that's a great question. So And when you say that you work through it with a group of people and they would identify more with Solomon or with the women in the harem, when they confess that, are they confessing it in the sense of pride or in the sense of, I wish I wasn't? Mm-hmm. The latter?
Like, I wish I wasn't.
Yeah. So that's where the beautiful hope of the gospel comes, that we have... As we saw in the book of Jeremiah, where the unfaithful wife, would God ever bring her back? The only way he can is if through their repentance, they experience a forgiveness that is such that it's as if they've never sinned. It's as if they never acted like Solomon, or they never were among the ladies in waiting. It's as if they, I mean, how else could we say it? They're reborn. That's the whole point. You're reborn as if it's a brand new start, and you have a God who's now all for you and who's looking at you through the blood of Christ such that you can indeed have a fresh start. So that you become, you transfer from the Solomon figure to no longer Mr. Fool, but Mr. Wise. And you can transfer through the blood of Christ from being the ladies in waiting who were somehow delighting in their objectification. Because now I have someone who's close, and he has money, and I'm protected, but it was all a facade. And it wasn't eternal. And now they see it. And through the blood of Christ, they can all of a sudden become the true woman of peace. The Shulamite. The true woman of peace who can be a haven for her man. And God can make all things new. That's the beauty of the gospel. That's how I would approach them. And we don't just have Song of Songs. But I think the rest of the Bible clarifies how we can move from being one of the characters to a different character in the story. And it's so hopeful.
What do you think the significance of verse 5, where it talks about them going to the location where his mother conceived him? What do you think the significance of that, aside from just being a description of the location, is?
I don't know. It's kind of weird. I mean, it's almost like they're celebrating that we have the opportunity given by God to reproduce a new generation in the very same spot that you were produced, my love. And it sounds weird, but it seems to me that's what they're doing. But it's done in a positive way, that you have children who are able to celebrate mom and dad's sexuality, and that it brought you into being. That is a gift of God. And it's worth walking back through the story and finding the spot. And I mean, it's as if this kid grew up and mom and dad saying, you were made right there. And the kid squirming, but then now he's mature enough to say, that's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. Because he's able to view conception and birth God's way. We got to take a break. come back in 10 minutes because I've got to teach one more book of the Bible.
Thank you for listening to this message from Dr. Jason DeRoshi. Feel free to make copies of it to give to others, but please don't charge for or alter the content in any way without written permission from Dr. DeRoshi. For more writing, sermons, and lectures, visit www.jasonderoshi.com. Proclaiming the kingdom, treasuring the God who reigns, saves, and satisfies through covenant for his glory in Christ.